From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Wednesday afternoon on Twitter when comedian Mike Birbiglia vented his frustration about movie ratings. First, a little background. You might know Mike Birbiglia from This American Life. He's been on many times. He's a masterful comedic storyteller, and he's become very close with Ira Glass. Birbiglia is also a filmmaker, but his films don't really have the backing of huge movie studios, smaller releases. He makes films he thinks have value, stories worth telling. Birbiglia's newest film is called Don't Think Twice. It's about an improv comedy group, but it's really about chasing dreams and deciding how long you want to chase them before maybe you settle down for a more banal job and life. It's about how to deal with a friend's success when the rest of a group is not experiencing the same level of success. In other words, there is no body count, there is no explicit sex, and it might actually make you think. But there is a scene where someone smokes a joint. So the MPAA gave the film an R rating. Here's what Birbiglia tweeted on Wednesday, quote, Suicide Squad has machine gun killings and bombings and got a PG-13 rating. Our Don't Think movie gets an R because adults smoke pot. Confusing? Well, that tweet set off a wave of reactions and commentary. Director Judd Apatow tweeted, quote, The fact that you can murder hundreds in a PG-13 movie but not say the F word twice is a scam. That is not cynical, just true. End quote. And Ira Glass himself tweeted, quote, I guess the geezers at MPAA haven't noticed. Shootings are a big problem in this country while weed is being decriminalized, end quote. Well, this morning, Birbiglia released a new film poster for Don't Think Twice. On the bottom is the R rating, and in the box that explains why the film got an R, it now says, quote, Friendships, humor, explicit truths about life, someone smokes pot, realistic male shirtlessness, no murders, a studio won't make billions. End quote. So there's why it gets the R, Mike says. This hour, we have a conversation about priorities, what we allow kids to see. Maybe your teenager saw The Expendables 3, a film rated PG-13 that has a body count of 500, characters using guns, grenades, knives, swords, and more to kill hundreds of enemies, but no marijuana, so PG-13. Or how about Love is Strange, the 2014 film? Featuring John Lithgow and Alfred Molina, critics loved it. They called it a beautiful and delicate portrait of a gay couple's unexpected struggle with homelessness. It was rated R, and more than one critic wondered if the MPAA has a different standard for films that feature same-sex relationships. Let's welcome the panel. They're going to tackle all of this and more, and let me go ahead and welcome my guest for the hour. Melissa Sturge Apple's here. She's a parent and a psychology professor at the University of Rochester. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you.
Also here is Tom Proietti, resident scholar in media at St. John Fisher College, longtime friend of this program, and someone who has, I know, studied well this kind of issue and the way media projects violence and these kind of things. It's great to see you here, Tom. Thanks for
being
here.
Good to be here, Evan. Thank you.
Adam Lubito is a film critic for City Newspaper. Adam, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Deb Rosen's Managing Director of Strategic Partnerships at Hillside Family of Agencies. And Deb, welcome to you as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And let me also welcome Makana Chuck. She's an Interim Director of Media Studies and Associate Professor of Communications at Syracuse University's S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Welcome. Nice to you.
All right, well, let me just kind of go around the table and just ask, am I off base here? Is Mike Birbiglia off base here? I mean, Melissa, you're a parent. Your kids are how old?
11 and 13.
11, so they're right in this range.
Right in it.
Maybe seeing PG-13. Do you talk to them about, you know, film ratings, these kind of things?
I don't talk about ratings. It's interesting because I actually, my two kids are very different in terms of what they can stomach, I guess, or take at a movie. My older child is much more open to kind of, like, he sees Scream, for example. My younger child is much more sensitive. So part of it is also kind of gauging. So they've seen different things, I guess. I have not seen a scary movie in a long time because of my younger child. So, but it's, you know, it's somewhat dependent.
And your work, what I find really interesting is that you are a parent of kids right in this age range, but your work also has looked at, among other things, sociological development of children. And you know, so you're not here to cite every raw study that's been out there about the way media violence impacts child development, but I wonder if that makes you think a little more closely about what kids are seeing on screen.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's lots of studies out there examining kind of the influence, mostly on, I think, television, because children are much more prone to watch television shows. It's much more accessible than movies, for example. But we do know that, you know, for your young children, for example, they see things much more real. They interpret characters as much as being very real to them. So what they see, they take as strong reality. Whereas when we're getting in adolescence, they have a better understanding of different perspectives and a better understanding of that this is a make-believe world. So I think that's, you know, there's definitely developmental differences in how they impact kids. But there's definitely, you know, research showing that, yes, what they see influences them.
And the younger they see it, the more the sort of the sticking influence, right?
Yeah, they can't separate it. They think it's really reality.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Is, you know, separation of fantasy and reality is difficult, but you know, it's one of those things. Also, I know Debbie is the kind of parent who's probably deeply involved in the media consumption process. Mm-hmm. We just spent a week on Cuca Lake. We're at a place that had no Wi-Fi, very marginal phone service, and I had a 10-year-old and 12-year-old granddaughters with me. But what they did have is a DVD player, so I brought some DVDs for them. One of them I brought for my wife and me is one of our favorite films called Chef.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, guess who wanted to watch Chef? Mm-hmm. And 10-year-old and 12-year-old. And my wife said to the girls, she said, there are no unusual sexual situations in Chef, but there's some very strong language, the kind of language I grew up in, listening in a bar, in a restaurant, in the kitchen especially.
Yes.
And, you know, my wife told the girls, the movie talk in here is kind of strong. I hope that doesn't offend you. And they watched it 6 times because it's great storytelling.
It's a great movie.
It's great storytelling, and they could identify with the 10-year-old son who, you know, is going through a really rough relationship with dad, they just really got into the movie beautifully. So, and back to, you know, what Mike is complaining about is nothing new. And Mike Verbiglia we're talking about.
But here we are, Tom. You said to me yesterday, you said you got to check out this film is not yet rated.
Oh,
that's 10 years old.
Oh,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have barely seen any movement to change the way, at least in this country, the ratings get applied here.
And at some point during this hour, we should explain, you know, the economic impact that an R rating has versus any other, you know, the PG rating is dramatic.
But that's why Birbiglia is saying, hey, this film's not going to make billions for its studio,
right,
which is one reason why he thinks they're saying, well, you know, two adults do smoke a joint,
right,
so we're
going
to have to give it. Do you think he has a point that he would
absolutely
have more economic sway over the studio to get, or MPAA to get PG-13 if it was a bigger release?
The wider release. You know, the other player in this, though, is that we really are, something Debbie just said, we really are moving to other platforms. And I think the MPAA is starting to feel the pinch of the reality that they're just virtually insignificant at this point. But they can have some impact on release.
Though, right?
Oh, but it's definitely still a power. It was much more powerful back in the 1930s when it was the Hays Commission.
And, Hays Code.
Yeah, the Hays Code, right.
Makana, why don't you jump in there? I mean, from your perspective as Associate Professor of Communications at Syracuse and Interim Director of Media Studies there, you know, these debates come up about violence on screen, the way they impact development. Do we sort of transfix too much about that? I mean, are we Pollyannish about it? How do you view this?
Well, there's been this long debate about does violence in the media have an effect on children and young adults? And the answer is it's yes and no, and it's complicated.
Well said.
You wind up, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of developmental issues, there's perceived realism, particularly among young kids. There's clear evidence of desensitization. The more you watch, the more accustomed to violence you become, both the violence you observe and to some extent potentially it increases your appetite. There's a reason why sequels are twice as bloody as the original.
That's an interesting point.
Because, yes, it is.
You know, people get
creepy,
inured to it. They want more.
And especially the really primary, McKenna, this is Tom Proietti, and as you know, the primary target for many of the sequels and many of the original films happen to be, you know, 12 to 34-year-old males especially, because they're the ones most likely to travel in packs and go see the movie on the first night and be really very strongly swayed by the incredibly violent trailers that are dumped in everywhere. You know, we used to say they were only dumped in on TV programming, but they're everywhere. I mean, and they're incredibly powerful.
You mean the film Jason Takes Manhattan about somebody killing an entire city?
Yes.
Maybe is an indication of elevating numbers as you go. I mean,
right.
I'd never thought about that. But that is such an interesting point, McKenna. But what about this notion of are we overemphasizing the risk of seeing drug use on screen, especially when, you know, you got Ira Glass pointing out 58%. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the study. Ira Glass was tweeting that, hey, we're moving toward decriminalization. A couple of states have done it. And I tried to grab Pew Research did it. So Pew Research first looks this up in 1969, and they found 12% of Americans in 1969 thought marijuana should be legalized, fully legalized.
And they all lived in Syracuse.
58% in the newest study. So a majority of Americans think we should fully legalize marijuana. And that's all Ira Glass is saying, how do you equate two people smoking a joint to get an R rating to compare to some of the other stuff that's out there? Is that a valid point?
It is a valid point. And there's, you know, issues with the violence in terms of what actual effects it has in terms of violent and aggressive behavior, violent play, other things are there's, you know, clear evidence of that. In terms of actual violent criminal behavior, we've seen a decrease in the crime rate at the same time that the content of media has become increasingly violent. The evidence for how much smoking we've seen, or is there relationship between showing adults smoking a joint versus behaviors, you don't quite get the stats on that because oddly enough, people aren't as willing to admit it.
Right.
But a clear issue might be the sex, because there's been this increased concern about sexual content and what you actually, you know, show depictions. And yet we also have a lot of data that shows that sexual activity among teenagers and young adults has been decreasing the last 20 years, dramatically in the case of boys.
Yes, absolutely.
I just saw an article headline this morning about how little sex millennials are having.
Surprise.
Well, they're so busy with other things.
Deb Rosen's a managing director of strategic partnerships at Hillside Family of Agencies. How do you view this issue?
So I view the issue from the perspective of being the mom of 12 and 14-year-old girls. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about might be interesting to hear what you're worried about for your boys versus what I'm worried about for my girls.
And let's hope they don't go to the same theater.
Right. But I'm also a social worker working in the field of child welfare for my entire adult life. So the two things are pretty wed for me. I want to say I'm a little bit of an outlier in terms of this perspective on behalf of my own children. I don't worry a whole lot about the violence that they're exposed to in media. I might feel differently if they were gamers and it was sort of more interactive. I don't really know, but they're not. But in terms of television and movies, I am significantly more concerned about what they observe in terms of gender identity. Sort of the big red flags for me are transactional sexual relationships and real substance abuse and glorification of substance abuse.
But do you draw a line as a parent then? Again, smoking a joint versus heroin, something like Trainspotting, a film like that, do you view them as equal or do you view them as sort of a sliding scale?
Maybe not even a sliding scale. I view them as very, very different.
Okay.
I'll tell you, the one time, so my husband and I, we all really love movies and we also love television. And the one time my husband and I ever uttered like a collective sort of gasp, more like a scream, was when our 14-year-old daughter said that she wanted to see The Wolf of Wall Street. And I thought, oh my God, if ever there were a film that I do not want my children to see, it's sort of every odious, pernicious message about money, about sex, about drugs. So, and certainly we do draw lines about violence. You know, and my kids are rule followers. So they say, well, Mom, you know, we can't see that. It's rated R. And it, I have to say that ratings are really just, they barely factor into my calculus of what I'm willing for the kids to see.
I find it interesting that you say that you're less worried about violence. And I go back to what Makanachak was saying earlier, which is that does violence have an impact on kids? And the answer is yes, no, and it's complicated. I was trying to come up with as much evidence as I could from what's out there. As we always say in this program, you know, we're evidence people, and we should be guided by evidence. And let me just cite a couple, and I'll kick it back to McKenna to kind of weigh in on this. First of all, in a Psychiatric Times interview, psychologist Dr. Craig Anderson, who's the director of the Center of the Study of Violence at Iowa State University, said the evidence for the media violence aggression link is pretty strong from every major type of study design: randomized experiments, cross-sectional correlational studies, and longitudinal studies. And there's also an often cited study going back to, the Surgeon General's Scientific Advisory Committee on TV and Social Behavior, formed in 1969 to assess the impact of violence on the attitudes, values, and behavior of viewers. Their report came out in 1982 by the National Institute of Mental Health, and it identified major effects of seeing violence on television. Kids may become less sensitive to the pain and suffering of others around them. Mm-hmm. Kids may become more fearful of the world around them, and they may become more likely to become aggressive in harmful ways towards others. But where it gets complicated is almost every study that I've seen finds socioeconomics and sort of child rearing and what's around you. In other words, privilege matters.
Yes.
Privilege
sure
matters here. And for kids who don't have a lot of context and guidance around them, this becomes poisonous to them if they don't have someone helping them sort of interpret and understand it. Do you agree with that, Makana?
Yes. One of the things, too, when we talk about what aggressive behavior is, this is where it gets into some of the it's complicated. There is clear evidence to show that, for example, kids who watch an aggressive movie will then go out and act out that behavior, sometimes in play. So they watch, they can watch mutant ninja turtles attacking each other, and then they'll mimic that and engage in these types of behaviors. Over time, they also may become more aggressive, have more aggressive attitudes, model certain behaviors, copy them, think these are socially acceptable. In terms of actual criminal behavior, that's where a lot of it may depend upon the individual, may depend on their society, on their social structure, the emotional, again, you're right, privilege matters. Are the parents co-watching? Are the parents having those conversations with them afterwards? Are the parents setting rules about viewing? This has a major impact. There's also psychological differences. They've actually done some studies measuring brain activity and physiological differences, and they found that people who are inclined to aggression have processed violent messages differently than other kids. So some kids are fine, and other kids are paying a lot more attention, and they're taking things away from it that other kids are not. So there's actual individual differences in terms of who they are and who they are as characteristics, and then there's the socioeconomic factors as well.
Well, let me just get over to Adam Lubitoz, a film critic for City Newspaper, and I'm just curious to know, as a critic and someone who's consuming a lot of this media, do you see any shift? I mean, we talked about the fact that in 10 years since this film is not yet rated, it doesn't appear to be a shift in values from MPAA. Am I wrong? Are you seeing any shift?
I don't think so, and I think that sort of gets to the why that system is sort of antiquated at this point, that they're still holding on to the sort of an old morality, an idea of morality that sort of I feel like society has at least somewhat gotten away from. And so sort of it's this debate over the rating system is, as Tom said, nothing new. It's been going on since the
system started. But what's going to happen with it? What do you see the future of movie ratings then?
It's tough because I feel like the more it changes, the more the MPAA is sort of digging in their heels. So I feel like hopefully it will change and it may change, but I still think it's going to take a long time still. It's just sort of at the heart of the debate is sort of their arbitrary distinction between like something like PG-13 and what's R. The holding on to violence is more acceptable to be seen by kids than sex or drug use, and in taking these two films, something like Suicide Squad is extremely violent, but it still gets the PG-13 rating because that's what the studios are after because that gets them the broadest audience. And the way they do that is they can still present the violence, but they tend to remove any blood from the violence, so it's sort of And sort of going off of the way kids watch and internalize, I feel like that's dangerous because that's sort of taking away the consequence of violence and making it into a fantasy,
what
and then they take it
point.
As real.
It's yes. not just pragmatic for the studio. It's even more harmful for kids because they're not seeing anything that resembles realistic violence.
Yeah,
they're seeing
exactly.
Right.
There's no after effect. I mean, just think yeah. of or the yeah. after effect the is really, really, the consequences are so significant. But we're not seeing those visibly.
Yeah.
Now, I think one of the ways we could fix some of this, is you, and Evan has heard me say this for 15 years now, is if we instituted media literacy in our schools, but we're not ready to do that.
And why aren't we ready?
Because, I worked for Time Warner for 5 years, and part of the thing that we did was lobby against any state any legislation that attempted to institute media literacy, because we don't want you to be media literate. We want you to be as media illiterate as possible, because then you're a great consumer.
But and I think that in order for media literacy even to be meaningful, we would also need to be instituting emotional literacy.
Oh, all
schools.
Kinds of literacy. Yeah,
and
right.
I bring
out John Gardner's handbook, you know, and we could
absolutely
go through all of them, right?
And you know, when I think about this issue of empathy and how it does interact with privilege, I often say that my children are living in a privilege bubble, and the threats to that are really quite specific, and have more to do with gender than they do with sort of other factors.
Amen. You're spot on.
So when I observe my children's reaction to television and movies, one of the strongest reactions that I ever saw from them, and it actually happened in a book before it happened in the movie, it was in Harry Potter. And it's the moment, for my kids developmentally, it was the moment in which characters that they deeply loved started being tortured and killed through interpersonal violence,
right,
which is real in Harry Potter. Right. And that was really the challenge to empathy, because, of course, they had this, like, empathetic outpouring towards these characters that they loved, whereas the distancing that they're able to do from shoot 'em ups, and frankly, they do watch them, and they're really into superhero movies, so they see death by the hundreds. It's just a categorical difference, and I think that does... There's something about this interaction between how much we equip our children to be talking and thinking deeply about emotions and feelings and relationships, and where that sort of intersects with their media consumption.
Well, I could leave right now. I just, after hearing that explanation, I'm going home. No, that's truly brilliant, because that's so spot on. And then what it does then is magnify how deep and profound this issue is, because here you are in what you call the privileged bubble. And
right. You're
struggling with it. Think about what's happening to the typical child who's not in, you know, so many are not in any kind of protective bubble at all.
And in fact,
my wife
at
was
great
a,
risk.
Right.
Yeah.
And my wife was a kindergarten teacher for 22 years in the Rochester City Schools. And she would frequently hear, you know, I would go to class and go to her class and talk about, what's your favorite TV show? I was hoping they'd say Sesame Street, and they'd tell me Freddy Krueger. Which meant they had Cinemax and they're watching the worst possible movies. And this was long before DVRs. And they're watching them in real time, which probably means 2 o'clock in the morning on Cinemax. That's terrifying. That's a world that I would never allow my children or my grandchildren to be in. But so many of our children are. They're unguarded, unprotected.
Professor Chuck, I know your time is short here. So how would you respond to some of what you've heard here? And I know that leaving at the half hour mark, what do you want to leave with the audience?
Well, actually, I agree completely, and particularly about the media literacy and that, sort of the empathy literacy or emotional literacy. There have been attempts to teach media literacy in schools, but it's not that, you know, funding isn't there or the programs don't quite work. And a lot of times what we're seeing is some things that are targeted more towards advertising or making kids aware of it, which may be one of the reasons why they're not that wild about having these incorporated into classrooms.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah, but a lot of this is, as I said, it's sort of a yes, no, and it's complicated. And parental role plays a major aspect here, and that's one of the areas where not all parents have the time or the resources to spend time with their kids. Not all parents are there, or to co-watch or to be aware of what their kids and children are watching. And to some extent, this is going to be even more increased because there's a lot more available, not just on television and through film, but also through the internet. And we're just starting to look at the impact of things like virtual reality and other types of things, which really increase the empathetic type experience. But, so it's a developing world.
Well, thanks for weighing in from Syracuse University's S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. We appreciate the input.
Okay, great. Good talking to you.
All right, that's McKenna Chuck. She's got to go, but our panel is here. We are loaded up here for the rest of the hour, and we're going to try to get through as many of your comments as well that have been coming in online, on Twitter, at Evan Dawson, on email, and then if you want to call the program, you can. I hesitate to give out the number because it's already ringing, but I'll just go. I'll do it anyway. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. It's 263-9994. Short break and more on prioritizing, well, violence, drugs, etc. How do we decide what kids should see and not see at what age? That conversation continues next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections. We talk a lot about walkability and urban planning. When we talk about walkability, we almost always focus on Rochester and urban centers. But the suburbs are saying, what about us? The villages are saying, what about us? Well, we're going to talk about suburban and village walkability. It's not just an urban issue. That's Monday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Melissa Sturge-Apple is here. She's a parent and psychology professor at the University of Rochester. Deb Rosen, Managing Director of Strategic Partnerships at Hillside Family of Agencies. Deb is also a parent of two, right around that time where they'd be getting in the movie theaters and checking out PG-13 or R. It's kind of what we're talking about this hour as we talk about the discussion about what we rate and how we do that. Adam Lubito is a film critic for City Newspaper, and Tom Proietti, who has taught media communications, media literacy. He's taught media literacy, even if not a lot of other people have.
Well, no, most of the world is not in favor of media literacy because it's a, you know, just think about the battle over Common Core. The Common Core has nothing to do with the thing that we do as much of, if not more of, than anything else. We do media. And it'll never be part of the Common Core battle. I would say we have to, you know, it's financial literacy. You talk about this all the time. I mean, it's the literacies that we need to be taught are so many and so varied. And they really are quite simple to do if we really wanted to do it. But we have an entrenched public, you know, a publishing industry that will never let any of this stuff go.
I'm a little more sanguine than you.
I know you
on
are.
This, but
I'm so full of conspiracy theories.
Well, you've seen,
you know, Donald
decades.
Trump is a candidate in 2016.
Hold on. The whole goal was to go 2 hours on this program
no,
and not
no,
say
I had
the
to
word
say it.
Trump.
I had to say it. I'm 70 years old. I'm going to die soon. I sound like Mel Brooks.
Let me grab a phone call first. This is Beth in Rochester. Go ahead, Beth.
Hi, everybody. I am a early childhood educator here in Rochester, and
you are going to heaven, Beth.
I just wanted to point out, I didn't hear anything talked yet about the youngest of the viewers who are, you know, ages 2 and 3, 4, some even younger than that, who are allowed to watch the superhero shows or other shows where they show superheroes solving problems by using their hands and using violence, really, to solve their problems, and teaching these young children how to solve their problems in that way, physically, rather than speaking with people and talking empathetically with someone about what their problem is. So I just wanted to put that sort of out there, and if anybody wanted to comment on it, I'll take the comments off the phone.
Yeah, Beth, thanks very much. We have been focusing on sort of the teenage years. I do find this comment interesting, because as the parent of a 4-year-old, we visited some friends and they said, well, we're going to put The Lion King on. I was amazed at how violent The Lion King was. I mean, my son was 2 at the time, and I'm going, I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, and I hadn't really realized that. And then, of course, he saw Cars, because in this country, you are mandated by law for young boys to see the movie Cars.
I hate that movie. But
it's a rite of passage.
I liked it. It was fine, but I was told by everybody, do not let them see Cars 2 because Cars 2 is pretty violent.
It's very violent.
And so, you know, so this, I do find this interesting. And Melissa Sturge-Apple has been, again, she mentioned earlier about the fact that the younger the child, the more things stick. Mm-hmm. When your kids were younger, how much were you thinking about, you know, ostensibly G-rated or ostensibly kids-friendly stuff that maybe had some questionable material?
Definitely thinking about it when they were younger. Unfortunately for them, when your mom's a psychologist, they don't get free reign of everything. So, but yes, I think her point is well taken that, you know, a lot of this has such an impact, as we were talking about, with young children and their developmental stage, and Deb can probably speak to this as well. And I think that's kind of a nice point from the woman from Syracuse about it depends, because it really does depend to a certain extent on, you talked about your granddaughters and, you know, explaining things to them, explaining
context
and so on and so forth. But I, you know, would never advocate for young children watching really violent adult movies, because again, to them, that's real. And it's very hard to make them understand it's not real, because they don't have perspective taking at that age to understand that someone else's reality is not their reality. They see everything as, you know, they feel like I do. They can't take another perspective. So I think it's very important for young children.
And the parallel I see, by the way, with Birbiglia, because again, we started this hour with Mike Birbiglia's new film. He's a comedian. His new film is not a widespread release. You might end up seeing it at a little theater. You might not. I know there were some questions about that. But right now it's in 60 theaters nationwide. It's got some actors who, if you saw the movie poster, you'd say, oh, I recognize that from Key and Peele and other places. But it's not, you know, the super high wattage stars. And he's frustrated to get an R rating because there's a scene where they're smoking a joint. But he's saying, look, the point is, this is a film about life and friendships and real thoughtful subjects. And you shouldn't be trying to shrink the audience just because there's one scene where someone smokes a joint. And I think as a parent, the parallel to me, to what Beth, the caller, was saying is, I think about, you know, shows for my son. And he doesn't know it, but I am thinking, too, about what's more thoughtful. You know, what is it Paw Patrol or Doc McStuffins or, you know, Chuggington? All of these things that, I'm geeky, but I am thinking about what is more thoughtful. And I believe that you can be a creative storyteller and still have excitement. You can still have drama, but be thoughtful as opposed to just relying on violence to solve problems, as Beth saw. Does that make sense, Melissa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Do you want to weigh in?
Well, it absolutely makes sense.
Sure.
And so I sort of promised my husband I would tell this story because it's really cute and really to this point. So when our children were probably 3 and 5, we were watching The Incredibles a lot, which I think we can all agree is a wonderful movie. And we believe that it's thoughtful, it's a wonderful parable, et cetera, et cetera. It's creative, it's all manner of good things. Our 3-year-old at the time asked if it was scary. And we said something like, no, honey, we would never show you a scary movie, but it is thrilling. So in the climactic scene when the children are getting ejected from the airplane, our daughter curled up in a ball on the couch and she said, too thrilling. And she was scared.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's not just fear, but it's sort of like, you know, feeling emotionally overloaded or unsafe or not in control of your response that becomes very relevant for young children. So even a thoughtful movie might sort of introduce an intensity of emotion or even like an intensity of visual or sound or something that that renders a child feeling unsafe because it's just out of their comfort zone.
Yeah, and anyone with a toddler knows that young children have difficulty regulating their emotion.
Right.
So, and that kind of emotion reactivity, they can't kind of calm themselves down or bring that down. So that makes sense.
And by the
way,
one of the best TV spots that's being run right now by the Hillary Clinton camp that some people may have
there
seen.
There he goes again.
We have to bring Donald Trump into this again because there are so many children watching television, consuming media unattended by anyone else. And here they're playing the clips of things that Donald Trump has said that are poisoning their brains. And, you know, the guy he's terrifying. He really is. And, you know, gets back to, I wonder if, you know, if those folks at the MPAA would ever think and say, well, you know, maybe we should be criticizing this gentleman for the things he says.
This is a ratings
in
issue.
In prime time. It is a ratings issue. And it really is, but that'll never happen.
Well,
they're demonic, by the way.
Not to Adam Lubitoe's point, Trump, we do know, as Les Moonves said, Trump does mean ratings and money.
He does. He's
Adam Lubitoe's point earlier was follow the money
follow
when you want to follow the ratings, right?
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Let me grab another phone call. And this is Susan in Avon. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi. Evan,
hello.
Thank you. You know, when my children, they're now 31, 27, and 23, they used to watch Ninja Turtles. They really did. But I never let them watch any of the, you know, crazy stuff. Then.
It's totally crazy to see a ninja wielding a machete, by the way.
I would only let them watch Mr. Rogers. I wouldn't even let them watch Sesame Street. Isn't that ridiculous?
Oh, so you're the one.
No, I'm the one. Because it was too fast. And I thought they needed to, you know, think about what they were seeing. But none of my children, two girls and a boy, are now, and our boy, Glenn, is 23, and he played video games. He did. And now he's 23, so he can do whatever he wants, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he did, and some of them were violent, and I didn't like them.
Were you worried about the impact on him?
I was worried about the impact on him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And sometimes, as we said earlier, you know, it's positive, negative, and complicated. And, you know, one of the things I'm very concerned about is just a waste of time, you know, just a time consumption. And go do something else. Go take a, you know, Mark Twain once said, go take a walk. You know, it's one of the best things you could ever do for yourself.
Exactly. Oh, my father used to say that.
but Susan, it sounds
it's like
you know,
are you feeling anxious? Take a walk.
Yes.
But Susan, are you thinking now in retrospect that those concerns that you had as a parent were overblown?
Yes.
You do? Okay.
Well, no, for my son.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't see it with any other son, you know, and my children have grown up just fine. My oldest daughter is a drama therapist. I'm on my way to Java Theater. I teach there.
Very good.
You Excellent.
Know, but, yeah, I, you know, my middle daughter is fine. But my son is fine, too. However, he, you know, he's still, I don't know. Yes, I would wish he was doing better right now.
Okay, Susan, I don't want to sort of litigate, you know, where he is in his life. I'm glad to hear that you feel like it was sort of overblown. But at the same time, I think this validates some of what Deb Rosen was saying earlier, which is that her kids, Deb, had the benefit of a parent who was actively worried about that, probably talking to them about that, having those discussions. And now she looks back as a parent and say, well, maybe I shouldn't have worried. But maybe you would say, well, maybe you should have, which is exactly why things are, you know, sort of no big deal.
And maybe my kids would say, maybe you should have. I mean, it is, you know, again, it's our children are more rule followers than we are. And I think that if they were here, they probably would have said, yeah, you talked to us about it, but maybe we didn't need to see that.
Right.
So.
And what, can I add something else?
Go ahead.
The media are just part of what we used to call, and we still do, a nexus of mediating factors. There's genetics. There's hunger. There's mm-hmm. the kind of food that you eat, the environment that you grow up in, how much sleep you have. You folks are the psychologists. You know, there's so many things. But one of the things we love to pick on is the media because we can isolate them. But
yes.
The other things, the genetics. I don't know what to do about genetics. You know, personal genetics. My dad died at 68, and his father died at 69. I'm 70. You know, and it's somewhat of a scary thing because I think I take fairly good care of myself. But you know, talk about this nexus of mediating factors.
Well, that's the question, though. I mean, does genetics make you more or less likely to
yes.
be influenced
right.
by media?
Right.
Or does parenting make you more or less likely to
right.
be influenced by media? And that's the joy of studying humans.
Mm-hmm.
They're not perfectly yeah. predictable.
Too many variables
yes.
to ever maybe isolate and say, consuming violent images will do X, Y, and Z.
But,
too many variables to say yes or no.
But we can do experimental kind of designs with this. And that's, I mean, classic Bobo doll studies.
Right,
you know?
Study. Yeah.
I mean, so experimentally, we can manipulate certain things and show that there is an effect. But that doesn't mean that happens for everybody. It means that there's also some individual differences there,
right.
like genetics.
Back to the original topic is the MPAA. And if you go back to them, the Hays Commission, and then this reign of terror that was conducted by Joseph Breen, whose name, it's a name you've probably never heard, but from 1932 till 1964 when he died, Joseph Breen, who was a Catholic fanatic in a nation that was at that time probably 25-28% Roman Catholic, he was the one that imposed most of these strictures on us. And it wasn't until he passed away that there was kind of this, for 4 years, there was this huge release where the artistry of cinema really came to life, but it terrified an awful lot of people. And who'd they bring in? Jack Valenti.
You know,
He was the Texan who came in and he was going to save us all again from, you know, from the wild world of cinema. But early cinema, before there was any regulation, for the first 30 years of movie making was really full of debauchery. And didn't ruin anybody as far as we can tell, but we don't really know.
Yeah. I go back to what Adam said. You kind of talk about how the MPAA does this
part of what they're doing with rating is they're choosing sort of this moral standard, and it's arbitrary, and it's going to be changed. We know that throughout human history, values and priorities change. Look at same-sex marriage. Look at drugs. Look at a lot of different things. And by the way, that's not me endorsing drug use, et cetera. Please don't email the program. But
which drug use are you talking
okay,
about?
Okay, but
I take Crestor.
But on this, no one's abusing Crestor in the films I've seen, Tom. Not that I can tell.
But that's coming.
Okay, but very seriously on the subject of drugs, here's an email from a listener named Lisa that I thought was very sort of attention-getting for a couple of reasons. First of all, Lisa writes, just wanted to point out that the 1980 film 9 to 5 was rated PG. Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin are shown smoking a joint. No consistency in the rating system. Yeah. Megan Mack, our producer, is the biggest Dolly Parton fan ever, and Megan will be able to confirm whether that is true. I think Lisa's right about that. But what that makes me think of is the fact that in 1980, a third of this country thought marijuana should be legalized. Now it's almost double that.
Right.
But it was PG for smoking a joint in 1980. From MPAA, and now two adults smoke a joint in a film that is otherwise about a comedy troupe
right.
and life and friendship, and it gets automatically a rating of R. And I find Lisa's point fair. That doesn't seem consistent, especially with where the mores are going when you look at the polls. Adam, I mean, how does that make any sense?
Well, first, I should point out that at that point, PG-13 didn't exist at all. Mm-hmm. That didn't come in until 84.
Okay, good point.
But it's also, I mean, there are so many issues at play. Sort of the MPAA, there's no set guideline. It doesn't stay the same from year to year or decade to decade.
It's arbitrary. That's the word you used, and I think it's the right one.
And that also comes into the issue with these, going back to the two films, the difference is in a film coming from the studio system and an independent film, because I mean the MPAA was started as a voice of the studios, and that's still the same today. The indie films that come in are outsiders, and so they have a much harder go of it in terms of what they're allowed to get away with.
And that was exactly it's exactly where we started this conversation.
Right.
And so now let me ask Adam on a different subject. We've been talking violence and drug use, sex. I want to talk about MPAA and whether they are anti-gay. And here's an interesting comment from
whether they are anti-gay.
Well, Tom's about to say, well, obviously. Stephen Whitty is a critic for the Star Ledger in New Jersey, and he wrote a review in 2014 of the film Love is Strange entirely about his view that the MPAA is anti-gay. And the name of his article was Why the MPAA Thinks All Gay People Should Be Rated R. And I want to quote from his review because, again, this is a film with John Lithgow, Alfred Molina, about a gay couple, two men in their 70s. It is a story. It's a film I haven't seen. But
it's a beautiful movie.
It's a film.
It's great.
It's an absolutely beautiful
movie. Okay, so It's not Brokeback Mountain. It's not, you know, sort of a film that has more physicality of a gay couple.
By the way, Evan, it's not at all salacious. It's not at all prurient. It's none of the things that we would normally consider vulgar.
Okay, so I guess there's one scene where they share a kiss. They're clothed. They cuddle in bed together. They're clothed. And here's what Stephen Whitty writes in the Star Ledger. Quote, yes, Love is Strange features some vulgar words, as do all the other R-rated films here on the list that he was giving. He says, in fact, the only reason given for the rating assigned Love is Strange, an R rating, is language. But in other films, on other subjects, the MPAA has sometimes shown considerable leeway on language, depending on context. And even this film's few strong words aren't spoken with violence, nor do they approach the wall-to-wall obscenity of some crime movies. This is a gentle, if often heartbreaking story about two loving men in a long-time committed relationship. What on earth is in it that so horrifies the MPAA? I'm sorry. I think I just answered my own question.
Yes, he did. Just so you know, the MPAA does have two chaplains, by the way, a Protestant chaplain and a Catholic priest, who are involved in the decision making. So just think about the intimidation factor that exists there. But back to Adam's point about this is a tool of the industry, and the industry doesn't want to see any artistry getting by them. They don't want people who are outside the industry to win awards or to make an awful lot of money to undermine their system. One of the coolest things that's happening is studios like Amazon and Netflix are just blowing up the entire system, and they don't pay any attention to the rating system. So the MPAA is kind of running for their lives on some of these issues. But notice they went after Mike and not after – they don't go after MGM or Time Warner.
Yeah, they're not going after a big studio. Go ahead, Deb.
So my question is there an entity that holds them to task for that?
No.
Because not only are they sort of engineering and informing the extremely robust economics around the filmmaking industry and its consumers, but they are also informing the collective consciousness
Absolutely.
Of, you know, all humans.
Yes,
so
they are. Yeah.
So is there some exercise through which there can be something more than this really insightful writer speaking out against it?
Is absolutely nothing. I mean, Tom brought up the film, this film is not yet rated, which I definitely recommend everyone check out because it goes through exactly what the MPAA is and sort of exposes their practices. And I mean, filmmakers, the people on the board who are deciding these ratings are kept anonymous. Like, they don't even know who these people are that are sort of passing judgment on their films.
And they also don't really know, and that's why I question Mike Birbiglia on this, they don't really know the reason why it received. It may be the pot scene, but it may not be. And one of the things that they do to you, and if you watch the film, this film is not yet rated, you can see them saying to Kirby Dick, the filmmaker, saying, well, he says, if I take this scene out, will it not have an R rating? Well, we can't answer that. You'd have to resubmit, start the process all over again, which is incredibly expensive.
Oh, my gosh.
It's expensive, time-consuming, and it's a crusher. And especially if you're an independent filmmaker who doesn't have the resources. You don't have an attorney. MGM is sitting there probably with 250 attorneys who will take on anything. And by the way, MGM doesn't even have to worry about it because they're part of the system. It's really designed to keep – yeah, you have to think of the MPAA as a form of censorship.
Right.
And that's what they are about. And if you think about the damage they've done to film over the course of the last 100 years, it's absolutely spectacular because every great filmmaker in the United States, at least, has been sitting there saying, you know, this next scene, can I put this scene in? Just think about the intimidation factor that's been there by a group of yokels who are not artists. And what they've kept away from us as human beings. They should be imprisoned for what they've done.
And Tom, if I wanted to buy a house from you and I said, I love the house, I don't like the bathroom, and you said, well, what if I repainted the bathroom? I couldn't say to you, I need you to bulldoze the house first and then rebuild it, and then I'll tell you.
Right.
And that's what they're telling
exactly
filmmakers.
Right.
It's not happening.
It's a great analogy,
and,
yes.
And Adam, when it comes to gay couples, I mean, I think of this film that you and Tom both loved, this 2014 film that got an R rating that seems ridiculous. That's the kind of film that I would want my son to see.
Exactly.
A beautiful story, a moral message, a beautiful loving relationship. Is it hard for Hollywood to get real, authentic gay stories into film for this reason right now, do you think?
Yes, I would agree. I don't know. I just feel like the point we keep coming back to is the idea of parental involvement and sort of parents deciding what is appropriate for their kids to see. And of course, that being a two-way conversation, listening to the kids and what they're able to process and handle. And I guess I lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
I was going to say, I think it's unfortunate.
It's good to see the youngest person in the room. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's unfortunate that this is the perception of the rating system, because as a parent, I do use them, you know, to really gauge what my kids should see. And if it's not, and I actually now go to websites where they actually talk about, you know, more specifically what the content is. So it would be great if it could function the way I think it's supposed to function in terms of protecting children, informing parents of making good decisions about movies.
And definitely. Thank you. That's actually where I was
perfect
going with
place
that. Yeah,
and by the way, one of the strongest, the Center for Family Decency, I think it's called, has a film review service. Mm-hmm. And this film is not yet rated. They gave a minus four stars. They said truly one of the most despicable films ever made because it tries to undermine all Christian values. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just the opposite.
Right.
And so here's a group of people outside the industry who have bought in completely to, you know, a form of dominance and censorship that just shouldn't even be allowed.
If I could just interject one final thought, and I'll let the panel kind of sew it up for us here. I feel like, as a parent who is now looking at what my son watches, you know, he's only four, but eventually he'll be the age of a couple of our guests. He'll be a preteen. He'll be a teenager. He'll want to see a PG-13 movie. He'll want to see an R movie. But even now, I want quality storytelling. I want storytelling that doesn't have to have exactly every one of my values, but I want it to be thoughtful and have a reason, not just blowing stuff up. And I feel like right now the money, as Adam kind of keeps coming back to, and the power of the big studios, makes it harder to get good, valuable storytelling and more likely to see violence, especially the bigger the studio, the more likely violence gets a pass. I'm not a Pollyanna about violence, but I feel like it's harder to get valuable storytelling.
And I'm going
to
add one other thing to that, is you have to know that for Hollywood, more and more of the market is not in the United States. So it's in China, it's in India, and it's in places where you can't put words. So the thing that we all understand is explosions. Violence is a very easy thing to market to China, to India, to wherever else, Africa. Doesn't make it, you know, and so great storytelling takes an awful lot of time. It's highly meticulous. One of the best conversations I had last week was with my 12-year-old granddaughter, Elizabeth, after the first time she watched Chef, and we talked about, you know, what was going on in John Favreau character's life. And I just kept looking at her eyes thinking, wow, this child was so profoundly affected by this. And it wasn't any of the F-bombs that bothered her. It was the relationship.
By the way, the only unrealistic thing in that movie is he's not getting the girl back at the end. But anyway.
No way.
But otherwise, I agree. I enjoyed that film. Tom Proietti, Adam Lubito, thank you. Thanks for your insight. And to the parents on the panel with these fascinating psychological backgrounds, I mean, must be tough to be your kids, but I also think they're very fortunate to have you as parents. Melissa Sturge-Apple and Deb Rosen, thank you to you both as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Andrus, the engineer of the broadcast. Thank you, John. Megan Mack is the producer of this program. I'm Evan Dawson, and thanks for all the feedback. What a week it's been. It has flown. Have a great weekend. If you missed any of the program, subscribe to our podcast and check out Weekend Connections, the podcast, where we kind of sort through what we think of the highlights of the week. But otherwise, we will talk with you Monday afternoon.